All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with ExchangeWire. Delighted to have as our special guest in the studio here this morning, Adam Ray, who's CEO and founder of 59A. Hello, Adam.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Adam confessed he's not media trained, to which me and Lindsay were astonished.
We're delighted.
And confessed that we're not either. So it's all good.
Brilliant.
The less media trained you are, the better you
Indeed.
Are for my tech podcast.
Good. Absolutely.
I've got a list of swear words all lined up.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, well, because you'll have noticed, obviously being a regular listener, as you also confessed.
Absolutely.
You'll have
Number
noticed that
fan.
Kieran's heavy on the swear words.
Yes.
Myself and Lindsay, a little bit more refined in our approach.
We're reserved,
would you say?
We?
Yeah,
yeah,
that's what I'd say. And anyway, of course, next guest, Lindsay.
Oh yeah, hi.
Welcome. Good to have you back in the podcast seat, Lindsay.
Thank you. Good Kieran, to be here, of course.
Yeah. Kieran was getting on my nerves the last two podcasts, so this is good. Right, so let's launch into the first sort of news story item of the week that I wanted to chat through with you two guys. This is actually a statement that's come from the IAB in the US this week in response to Congress and the FTC in the US urging the government to agree a data privacy law. Which is linked to, or I suppose a step beyond do not track. So their argument is that the current controls that are available to users and consumers in the browser aren't sufficient since they create a false understanding of consumer data, they victimise consumers, and they create this misbelief that consumers can be safe by just clicking a checkbox in your browser controls saying, The checkbox that currently exists that says do not track, right? And that will kind of solve everything. So the IAB's position was that the debate that underwent in the US this week was really important, and that they agreed strongly with lawmakers that the US government needs to do something substantial around data privacy and regulation and control, which sort of seems a little bit in line with perhaps GDPR, or at least the sentiment behind GDPR. But the IAB's perspective is that it needs to be a step beyond options like Do Not Track. They're calling it Do Not Track Plus, their perspective. They're saying that that the reason that they feel this way is because although various technology solutions and providers, some big and multinational, some smaller, are coming up with sort of privacy tools, that's useful. It's sort of heading in the right direction. But actually, if we don't have one unified approach to this, then things will fall through the gaps, and actually consumers won't understand what's protecting them, and they won't necessarily know how to use those tools. So they were sending out a really strong message that they feel that government regulation is the right thing, but that it needs to be something that is applied universally. So I'm interested to hear what the both of you think about this. Adam, let's start with your perspective.
I was checking through the article yesterday, and I think to me there's kind of three sections to it, the article they released. I think they're talking about standardization, which you touched on, and I think absolutely that's needed. And we were chatting earlier on that I really like the quote which they throw out there that, you know, you don't have 1,000 different designs of seatbelts, you kind of have one. And if you look at the seatbelt history, which I know is a bit boring and a bit geek, but...
Have you done that, Adam?
I have. Well, do you know what? I honestly don't know why, but I knew that before I even picked up on that quote, which is... I know it's bad. It's bad. It's part of my media training coming out here. Volvo were the guys who created the seatbelts. They were the boring story, but they then released the actual design for free to the industry to because they knew the importance of it.
To standardise things, yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, all these different companies... small, medium and large trying to create their interpretation of standardization is only going to cause more of a headache. So the idea of having one like the seatbelt is a great analogy. And then, so that's the first sort of thing, we need standardization. But, you know, the idea of herding cats springs into mind, and there's hundreds of cats. That's a big problem. This is a start point, I'd say, and it's important, and the ambition is correct, but it's only a start point. Mm. Choice, I think, was the next thing. And again, each one of these individual points is... massive in its own right, and we could probably spend weeks and then in the pub later on chatting more about them. But choice, making it easy for consumers, it's not an easy thing to decide for a consumer. And do consumers really still understand the value exchange between getting the content they're after without paying for it, but arguing against, but selecting not to allow the publisher to make revenue to cover the costs? And that's a whole massive educational thing. And then the third big thing out of that is around penalties, which they do talk about. And I think that might be the catalyst to actually force and achieve the standardization and the choice elements. And without that, you're going to run into this problem of cats running all over the shop.
Yeah.
So they're the kind of summaries and implications. There's big implications, but that's sort of my initial line of thinking.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I completely agree with everything you said, Adam. And I think that the three big points, exactly that. First of all, do not track as a thing is a complete farce, because do not track does actually track. And if you go and turn on do not track in Chrome, for example, if you go into back out of that, I don't think when you click on do not track, it actually tells you the information. But if you go to the customer support section of do not track, it says do not track does not mean that browsers will not still be able to track what you're doing and websites will not still be able to track what you're doing. It actually says, I'll read it actually, because it's quite interesting. Many websites will still collect and use your browsing data to improve security, provide content, services, ads and recommendations on the websites and generate reporting statistics. That's if you have do not track switched on. Most websites and web services, including Google's, don't change their behaviour when they receive a do not track request.
So what's the point of that?
So do not track doesn't need to be called do not track plus. It just needs to be, just needs to exist as a thing in the first place.
Yeah.
And it comes down to, once again, that Adam, what you said, consumers do not understand the value. Well, first of all, the value exchange. They don't understand, you know, what it is they're saying yes or no to half the time and what it means they'll get in return. The you know, we've got GDPR in Europe. The big thing about GDPR is many people, I think in this industry too, many people still believe that GDPR means that consumers won't receive ads. Actually, it just means they'll receive less relevant ads, which could bring us back to, you know, to 10 years ago when every ad we saw was just completely irrelevant, driving us insane, following us around the internet kind of ad. What would you rather? Would you rather something that's irrelevant or would you rather something that's more relevant? Mm. I have noticed there's a lot more notices on websites now saying you will receive less relevant advertising rather than just saying tick this box to receive ads or whatever. So people are being clearer because they have to, and because fines are becoming real. Mm. So they're understanding they have to kind of be explicit to consumers. But consumers still don't really understand what it is they're looking at.
Yeah.
So maybe we do. Maybe the US does need a federal level style guideline that everyone uses. But again, as we're seeing with GDPR, GDPR is a directive. It's not a law. And it just means it's open to interpretation. And that's what's clearly happened in Europe. There's been a lot of interpretation, too much interpretation. If the same thing happens in the US, you're still going to sort of be back at square one.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a lot more that could be done.
And I think they sort of make the point, actually, in the article that what currently exists is contradictory, and at the same time, it's too much and not enough.
Yeah.
So it's created a situation of too much and not enough. Not enough explicit direction and not enough explicit information so that consumers understand it. And then it's created an opportunity for too many people to release all sorts of tools that people could use but that don't actually end up protecting your privacy any better than if you did nothing. And the interesting thing about what you said there, what you've just said there, Lindsay, as well, is that I found it interesting that they talked about how what currently exists has sort of coaxed people into thinking there's a few buttons that they could switch on and off and then that fixes everything. And Do Not Track's a perfect example of that. It actually does nothing. But then it also connects to the podcast conversation we were having last week, which was focused on Google's ITP approach and this proposal of a dashboard that enables you to control, you know, what kind of browser controls and cookie tracking goes on within your browser activity. And we were asking ourselves the question, to what extent do users and consumers care? And I think that courtesy probably of a bit of a GDPR sort of, you know, a melee of misunderstandings and miscommunications, these days I find that a lot of people are just anxious to get to the content, knowing that they ought to consume some advertising in exchange for the content, because they generally understand that value exchange, although I agree with you, Adam, it's not well understood because it's not well articulated. And they just kind of think, oh God, all these pop-ups are coming on. Yes, yes, whatever, whatever. Okay, I just need to get to the contents. And that seems to negate the whole purpose of all of this. So it feels to me like we need, users and consumers need to be far better educated about the point of advertising in the first place and the relevance of it and what these technology tools are doing to try to enable some relevance. And then the industry needs to take responsibility for some overarching guidelines and principles that have got some consistency to them so that people actually have control over things that matter. And we need to stop worrying about the things that don't matter so much.
Yeah.
I think the majority of people are prepared to deal with advertising advertising in order to consume content for free.
Yeah.
If they're consuming that content for free.
I think, and I agree with all that as well, I think in terms of the industry taking control, I guess it's the question of how realistic do we think getting the large typical players, of which we're all familiar with, medium and small players, to work together to agree one Volvo-sized seatbelt. And that I think is...
That's going to be the challenge.
You know, and I struggle to look back to industry-wide large initiatives for such highly complex areas and point to large successes, which I know is a thing we come on to later around the policy and frameworks in the US for starting to fall apart already before it's even started. But I struggle to see how the industry is going to be able to pull together to find that one consistency.
Yeah, and I think that
not to be negative about it all, but
no, I know what you mean.
I agree. I think that the IOB Europe's transparency and consent framework, which is designed to obviously be, but again, it's not something that everyone uses as a rote. It's a framework for you to use as you see fit. And we've had fines already in France where companies have implemented it incorrectly. So you have to know how to use it and use it correctly. They've just released that they're about to release version 2.0. But that is the one place where everybody in the industry is supposed to kind of band together, all enlist their support and services inside the TCF, inside the framework. And the big argument has been over the past year, because we are now, it's now a year since GDPR came into play, which is incredible, really, was that while Google have put a lot of money and time and effort into building the framework, apparently, they still weren't actually listed as someone that could be tracked, that you could choose to track or not to track using most consent management platforms.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a big argument around that. Like, I can say yes or no to all these obscure ad tech companies I've never heard of, but I can't say yes or no to Google because they're not listed in it yet. And that was a big frustration. That apparently is going to be changing. But Adam, you're absolutely right. Like, if we can't get everyone together, then what's the point of it? And the big players, and again, the way that that Randall Rothenberg and Dave Grimaldi described one big player in this article was hilarious. I need to find it and read it. What was it? It was called, so when platforms and browser manufacturers, especially giant, vertically integrated, data-rich platforms and browser makers, I wonder who you could be talking about there.
So, that's a puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it's just so passive-aggressive. It's amazing. Yeah, I love it. But it is like they are, everything they do, they're doing for themselves.
That's the trouble.
And that's, right. You know, ITP. They're doing it for themselves. Their new data privacy controls, they're doing it for themselves. They aren't necessarily doing it for the consumer. A lot of it is lip service. But also, are we plunging millions of dollars and hours of resource into these kind of these big initiatives that actually only really cater to the few rather than the masses? Because ultimately, when you look at the average consumer, the masses don't really give a crap.
That's the trouble, right? So, and it's interesting. I mean, you're right. You say that, you know, that certain, what were the words that Randall Rothenberg used? Certain giant, vertically integrated
data-rich platforms, data-rich browser platforms. Makers.
Yeah. Certain companies that fit that description may well be looking to furnish their own interest in the first instance. But we talked about this last week as well, too. They've also got an interest in a thriving ad tech ecosystem, right? It's to no one's benefit to see that dwindle away and become a kind of benign marketplace. So you're right. They're looking after their own interest first, which is what all commercial companies do. And that's what makes me think this is kind of sort of, and I wonder whether this is happening from a political perspective in the US as well, it's sort of going hand in hand with the conversation about breakup of big tech as well. So it's that rolling alongside and what does this mean for data privacy and consumers' protection, you know, and the government needs to do something here. But I guess the question marks remain over what it is that the government does, over how unified the industry can get or not, and over how much individual users and consumers care and what is it that they should be caring about and how can we kind of tap into that rather than create lots of unnecessary layers of bureaucracy that aren't touching anyone or relevant to many people?
Yeah. But I guess also, you know, with ITP in place, kind of what advertising channels are left where you can target consumers the best you can. I mean, obviously it's context-based, right? And the biggest context-based channel that exists is paid search. And Google owns the entire paid search industry pretty much. So actually, if they're introducing kind of this do not track or introducing ITP 2.0 to their own browser, then all their advertisers will just put their money back into search again. So Google will still win.
Yeah.
Potentially.
cheerful note on which to on which to move on to the next story that I wanted to discuss with the two of you. Article that appeared in Business Insider this week following TV upfronts in the US and talking about how the TV industry is kind of stalling in their efforts to get their advertising act together. The article was pointing in particular to some of the sort of measurement and buying initiatives that have been launched in the TV industry over the last couple of years, designed to make buying a little more straightforward in a TV context, and I suppose designed in part to modernize the TV industry as addressable TV becomes, you know, more and more of an advertising opportunity. And about how those initiatives haven't necessarily done very well. They mention OpenAP, which was set to be a buying consortium across a number of US networks, but that some of those US networks have now pulled out, such as Turner and AT&T, because they're presenting, particularly AT&T is starting to put forward their own proposition, and also that buyers were reporting that OpenAP just wasn't a really straightforward marketplace, and that actually they were having to do deals individually with networks and broadcasters anyway. The article also mentions that, you know, I think everybody in the sort of tech side of the TV industry and maybe the ad tech side of the fence were hoping that Nielsen and Comscore would sort out some measurement issues in the TV landscape, and that hasn't really come to fruition either. So there was the article sort of underpins a bit of a sense of disappointment in how the TV industry hasn't advanced as much as one would expect from a technology point of view and also from a buyer's point of view. Now, it also highlights that consumption of linear TV is reducing year on year, and we know that. We all know that from our own habits. And we talk quite a lot at ExchangeWire about how addressable and connected TV is a real opportunity for ad tech and martech in the future. So I wanted to just hear both of your opinions on this, because it's one of the first articles that's come out in a while that's really saying the TV industry just still is not advanced in the way that we expect it to. It's still being run in a very old-fashioned manner. When are we going to see the opportunity for buyers to really harness, you know, something that's measurable and attributable in a connected TV environment?
Yeah.
Adam, what's your view?
I mean, there's a load of areas in there which need a lot of discussion. I think first thought really is the writing is on the wall, that the value of being more personal to the consumer helps people understand more about brands and buy more, sell more, you know, better communication. So it's a benefit for the businesses fundamentally. Second thought is then it's kind of a bit like the year of the mobile. You know, every year for a decade, it's the year of the mobile. This has been dragging on a lot longer. I think the bits you hit, you know, technological lack or the apparent lack of technological development. I think if you flip the view of that, you know, look at companies like Amazon, who are taking a technological step with the Fire Stick to plug into TVs to gain control effectively of how people consume the content, and therefore they're maneuvering themselves into an interesting position from an advertising perspective. So, you know, if the industry isn't moving under its own steam, companies are coming in, and, you know, look at Netflix, they're one step away, you know, that's always a debate, from running addressable TV ads on their platform.
Yep.
And it's kind of, you know, if you're not going to change in terms of the old, and I got told not to use the word dinosaur, but if the dinosaurs aren't going to change,
you haven't been media trained. Excellent.
I got told, don't say that, but I'm like, well, so I haven't said it necessarily.
I mentioned I wasn't supposed to say it, so that's good, right?
And it's like, you know, and you cannot stop the progress of technology, and those couple of examples I've just listed off reflect that. Yeah. And you know, you touched on the other point around consumption across multi-screen. You know, I mean, I don't literally have over-the-top TV. It's all internet connected, and that trend is happening. And whatever the other word of dinosaur I should be using, whether they accept that or not, it is moving around that. Mm. The writing's on the wall, and if you start to upgrade your ways of working, your processes, your business models, your resource base, basically go back to the drawing board and realize, like what we did for programmatic version one, what's the new operating models look like? This isn't an overnight solution. You know, these are infrastructure related changes. And if you're not going to change with it, you're going to get caught off guard.
Yeah.
And when that meteorite strikes, you know, that's the last dinosaur analogy.
Watch out, because we all know what happened to the dinosaurs.
I mean, yeah, I think particularly in the US, but globally, obviously the UK is very, very different from the US when it comes to TV, both consumption and advertising. But in the US, you know, there used to be it is, Adam kept talking about consumption, and it is really around consumption. You used to have like a TV studio that would create the content, they would sell it to a distributor, and then they would sell it to the consumer. So you have that, the clear path from content creation to consumer. And then the likes of Netflix are coming and completely changed that all around. So Netflix are also the studio, they are the distributor, they deliver, they're direct to consumer. Disney are doing the same thing. There's always different examples of kind of how the TV industry is completely changing and how consumption is completely changing. But then when it comes to the advertising and the measurement side of that, it's lagging behind massively. And while linear TV is still massive and there's still a huge sucker of ad budget in the US and in the UK, it is changing. If linear TV is starting to drop, then budgets need to kind of start moving. But, you know, as the article from Business Insider highlights, advertisers are trying to move it, but they don't really know how to. And if measurement can't be sorted yet, I believe in the last upfronts in January in the US, there was talk around this kind of this co-measurement, which Hulu and Roku are both going to sign up to. And the co-measurement would basically be a way of being able to match. Because obviously, if you're watching Roku, you can't assume, who knows if you're watching it on a phone or a TV, if you're watching it by yourself, if you're watching it with your family. So actually, you can't treat somebody watching Roku as a normal display ad impression because it could be viewed in any way, shape or form. So you have to treat Roku as something in the middle of traditional programmatic and linear TV. But how do you do that if you actually have no idea who's watching it and when? So they're trying to look at this co-viewing thing between Roku and Hulu. But I think that's become very complicated. Clearly, in the latest upfronts, it's not improved itself. And actually, you know, the biggest consortium that's existed, you know, their TV equivalent of Ozone Project in the UK from a TV perspective, and also EBX in the UK, European Broadcast Exchange, if AT&T and Turner are dropping out, then it shows that things are not developing. I know that the Trade Desk for a few years have been working very, very closely with Nielsen to try and develop new measurements so that they can actually kind of take connected TV seriously. But it's really, really slow, and the tech is there, and people are trying. Obviously, there's a lot of money and time going into this, but you can't beat the legacy of kind of 60 years of linear television, of traditional television. How can you change that kind of overnight? You can't. Yeah. And that's the challenge.
And I guess that's it, right? So, you know, the sort of the breakdown or the withdrawal anyway of a couple of networks from OpenAP says something about that, because they're looking to protect their own content and their own empire. And you know, I suppose we've talked about similar sorts of issues around publisher consortiums, that publishers traditionally haven't been used to working together because they've wanted to be very protective of their own audiences. And that just feels, TV just feels like it's that sort of times 100 because, like you say, you know, there's so much goes into network capabilities. They, you know, create original contents. They're not just delivering the television. They're also, you know, sort of writing it, you know, paying creative staff and actors and everything. And so it's such a big undertaking. You can sort of understand why they find it difficult to let go of it. And again, they're doing what all commercial companies do, which is putting their, you know, the sort of commercial aspect of their business before everything else, including, you know, trying to make it easier for advertisers to buy inventory across their networks. So you can see how that's happening, but it just doesn't feel like it's keeping pace with the level of change, because before you know it, there will be, I keep saying this and then I feel like maybe it's a stupid thing to say, but I feel like before you know it, people won't know what linear TV even is because young people just have no connection with linear TV at all.
Generation Z don't know what linear TV is. So they exclusively watch all of their content via kind of connected devices.
Yep.
And they wouldn't distinguish. They don't even know what TV is probably. They don't distinguish watching on a TV versus a smartphone. For them, they're just watching a screen, and that could be anywhere. And you know, the way that streaming works now, you can start something on a TV, then move it to your tablet, then move on to your phone, and that's the world they live in, and they don't understand anything different. So it's just us curmudgeons that are trying to understand how you can kind of live in a linear and connected world, whereas they only live in a connected world. And I think in America as well, like consumption of TV is baffling for consumers. There are all these skinny bundles. It costs you an absolute ton to watch cable, like something like $200 a month or something to watch cable, because you have to rent the set-top box for a monthly fee and all this other stuff. And then you've got all these skinny bundles. They're all showing the same shows but different shows, and every single company, like from AT&T to Hulu, they've all got these skinny bundles. Even Google have got one. And it's just baffling as to what am I paying for? We talk about subscription blindness. I think the US is the example of that with TV. But then You've also got kind of the, just the advertising in the US is just so different from what we're used to in the UK as well.
Yeah, and the BI article mentions that too.
It does.
That there was supposed to be a promise of decluttering advertising, and what that would mean for the user experience. And in fact, you know, they were doing some research on it, and it suggested that actually consumers were being shown more advertising rather than less, longer ads and longer periods of ad breaks rolled into one. I mean, that's just such an awful consumer experience. And I think we've mentioned this before in the podcast as well. We're so lucky in the UK to not have to suffer that, because that's what advertising is like in every other English speaking country. And I grew up in Australia. Advertising was much more like the American model, not as bad, but nowhere near as unintrusive as it is here in the UK. And
I'm thinking through in terms of let's fast forward into the future and think about once TV, which I believe is inevitable, will be entirely addressable. So fast forward to that future state. What I'm trying to think through in my head is what does the sort of diagram of that look like? You know, what does the measurement look like? What does the technology look like? What does the process look like to actually transact on it? What are the creative opportunities? What are the data opportunities? And as I'm going through those questions in my mind and trying to design what the diagram of this addressable TV model looks like, I think there's so many bits to it. And each of those individual bits are massive in their own right. And then I struggle with trying to think about the people at the top who can figure out the design of that diagram to wire it all together. And then only once that's been done and sort of, I guess, figured out, is the new building constructed, which we can then use and deliver addressable TV. It's not, you know, let's go and fix measurements and then overnight, oh, that's great, it's solved. It's not go and fix one of those individual bits, oh, and then great, it's solved. You know, it's like a bridge. You can only get to the other side once it's all put in place. And I think the problem itself is, and don't get me wrong, I've got a lot of lovely dinosaur friends. Kind of like that. I forget that American TV show, you know, and I don't want to do them in injustice by any stretch, but it is a massively complex problem with a multidisciplinary infrastructure required to try and get there. But I think like, you know, any industry, you know, outside of media, you look at communications, Nokia ruled the roost, and then Apple came in and blew them out the water. You know, and it's a warning from history that if we don't try and fix that bridge and get to the addressable TV island, look at all these analogies popping out of nowhere. With my,
I mean,
media,
they're amazing.
Training.
They're incredible analogies.
I mean, I'm really enjoying it because it's creating quite
addressable TV island.
I know. And with the dinosaur thing as well. I'm getting the impression you're very imaginative.
Thank you. Just well media trained.
Shows. Well, I just sort of wonder then where the drive is going to come from. So let's imagine that Netflix goes ad funded, which we keep talking about a lot. Does that really change the game? Is that the catalyst that really starts to get people thinking differently?
I think it will drive a level of change, but I think, you know, all of those different elements and probably many more, and each of those individual elements is going to be subsections to it as well. When those bits of the bridge are fully built, then it is resolved. But it takes trailblazers to try and begin that catalyst, and I think that'll definitely help contribute to it. But it won't be the solution in and of its own right.
Yeah,
I think you're right, because even if Netflix do go ad funded, I mean, you know, we've got some other big streaming platforms that are already ad funded. It doesn't mean every advertiser has flocked to them, because they certainly haven't. It takes a trailblazer and kind of marketers to do that.
And the existing way of working, look at that, I've changed from that poor analogy. The existing way of working still works well enough for advertisers and clients direct. So, you know, it's not that it's not working, but it could work a lot more effectively.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a hell of an interesting journey to go through that decade-long transformation, because this thing isn't going to happen overnight like the year of the mobile.
Yep. Lots of potential opportunity in that, which is what we keep talking about a lot, and particularly potential opportunity for, you know, the sort of ad tech players that aren't, you know, those that are outside the kind of currently dominant ad tech players in the display world. That's what makes it interesting.
Yeah, and we talk about ad clutter. Just to add to this, Hulu wants to add ads to pause screens.
Oh.
So if advertising in the US isn't bad enough already, when you're watching Hulu and you've got ads inserted throughout as you do, then when you press pause, then you'll have ads. I think static rather than video ads.
You know, on my Netflix, I swear that when I've paused Netflix to dual screen, obviously, there you go, there's another one, they start to promote other
shows.
Amazon Prime has started doing that
Amazon
as well.
Amazon Prime, so that might be the beginnings of, you know...
Maybe it is.
I'd love to see some research on what it does to a society to be exposed to that much advertising if you compare the US to the UK in terms of TV advertising. Because that is just such a high volume.
It's massive.
Isn't it?
Yep.
Mm, interesting. Anyway, on that note, sort of related but kind of not.
Yeah, close.
Yeah, that's... You can see I've been well media trained too. So... third article that I wanted to chat about, actually this was a press release that came across our desk at ExchangeWire this week, and it's a nod to sort of deviating from the discussion of the sort of usual topics that we have here on the Mad Tech podcast. It's a nod to Mental Health Awareness Week, which is currently underway here in the UK, and it was something that we felt was worth discussion because we don't spend a lot of time on the Mad Tech podcast or in ExchangeWire forums talking about things like mental health, but it's something that we think is really important because it's heavily connected to employee health and well-being. And we certainly spend a lot of time talking about how the various parts of the industry organize their business models, how tech companies organize themselves, how agencies organize themselves, and what makes for, you know, good functional working environment. So it felt like this was a nice opportunity to have a discussion about something a little bit different to what we'd normally talk about. So the release was focusing on Encore Digital, who are a data tech company, making the decision to change their working week for everybody in the company to a 9-day fortnight. So that's 9 days
for Americans. Who I was about to say, word fortnight
exactly.
Is.
Yeah, that's 9 days over two weeks. Yeah, 9 days over 2 working weeks.
Nailed it.
Yeah, yeah. We got there in the end. Took a long route though. And for poor Americans, I mean, they even work on Good Friday, so they're probably like, "Why? Who would ever do that? Make you only work 9 days over 2 weeks."
And they get
weeks.
Like 10 days holiday a year.
Yeah,
so,
totally. Yeah. So Encore Digital expects some applicants from the US for any openings. Anyway, it was an interesting piece. So they sent the release saying that they were doing this explicitly to contribute to employee health and well-being, that they felt it was a really important move to give something back to their employees. They weren't expecting anything in return, so it wasn't a quid pro quo. It wasn't a you've got to do the same hours but in 9 days, or you've got to return some of your salary to us. It was we're just moving to a 9-day fortnight, and there we go. And they also talked about how they felt it was really important to productivity. It was something that they felt was going to make staff more productive and more efficient. I think it's fascinating. You know, obviously ExchangeWire, we're a small company, so things are pretty flexible here, but we demand quite a lot of our staff. That's why occasionally poor Lindsay is off sick, because we break her with all of the pressure that we put her under. But, you know, because we're a small company, we've got quite a lot of a flexibility to be able to allow people to work from home and to be able to, you know, sort of allow different working hours in relation to some of the other things that we might all wind up doing outside of general work hours, like when we travel for events and things like that. But I'm interested to know, Adam, what you think about this, running your own company and having worked in the industry for some time, and also Lindsay, what your views are on it, having worked for big corporate companies in the industry like advertising agencies.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant, the fact that the Mental Health Week as an initiative. From a personal perspective, I've been fortunate to not experience some of the implications of mental health related challenges. I've had lots of very close friends who have, and I think that and witnessing it firsthand, it's a really terrible thing to go through. So from a personal perspective, any progress on any front is fantastic. So that's from a personal perspective. I think from a professional perspective as well, I think that there's almost an illusion around, as technology becomes more front and center of the day-to-day operations of business, there's an illusion that that means that people do less and less work. That's absolute nonsense. In a weird way, it's a dichotomy that people actually find themselves having to do more and more work. And, you know, recently there's been a few articles which come out around trader burnouts, and the statistics behind those articles are absolutely heartbreaking. And I think the industry needs to do more to address that. And just make it clear and open that it's something which we need to address, basically, as an industry. I think initiatives like a 9-day week, 9-day week, 9-day fortnight.
No, it's tough, isn't it? That's really going to lead us to dinosaur territory very quickly.
Mental health for everyone.
Oh, hold on, the wrong way around. 9-day president, what is it? I think that's definitely one way to go for it. But I think at the same time, I think, you know, pressure can be consistent and people taking time out for a day, the pressure is still there, knowing that when they get back to the office, it's still going to be what it was like before they left. So it's definitely a great step forwards. But I think as a journey, there's so much more which needs to be done. And we used to have things like buddy systems in place, which I know is a sort of easily, relatively straightforward buzzword system, but putting time into those buddy related systems with mentors, with peers, also helps just to you know, let people explain what's happening. But also from a management perspective, it's not management as in the people at the very top of the tree, but management at every level need to be very aware of the pressures which their team are facing and manage it proactively and make sure that there's a culture of openness that people can talk about it and address it, because burying it under the rug will keep the problem there. And it is heartbreaking to see it from a looping back to the personal perspective that, you know, and it's terrible. Not to put a downer on the conversation, but
yeah,
it's a heavy subject, but it's something which we must talk more about in the industry and not have it as much of a, as a, not a taboo subject, but
a stigmatized subject a little bit. Right. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Open communication is really key, I think, in this. Lindsay, what's your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think from an employee perspective, having come from a big media agency to Exchange Wire, so having come from sort of 400 people to eight, nine people, that the culture has been very, very different. And Adam, I agree with you, kind of things like the buddy system in the big corporate companies, you know, UX Mindshare, they were easy things to implement and that everyone had them. I certainly had them. We had mentor programs, regular catch-ups with your team to make sure that everyone was okay. They're obviously kind of just their hygiene factors, basically, to ensure that you're able to look after people. But it is this thing about, you know, people are not honest about their mental health and they don't want to show weakness and show they've got a problem. And, you know, as it's Mental Health Awareness Week, I'll be honest, I have sought professional help for anxiety and self-esteem. And, you know, working for a company like Exchange Wire, where we had that flexibility and I've been able to kind of be honest about that with you guys and have that support from you, has been invaluable to me and my kind of being able to kind of get through this and being able to grow from it. It's been very, very interesting. Would I have got that same level of support from the previous big corporate company? I would have got support. It would have been very, very different. But it might have been more, I guess, group-led support rather than me being able to come to you and say, I need to go and see somebody about this. It's been a big thing in my life. You know, it came from a family bereavement and I've been working on it since then. And actually having Exchange Wire to kind of help me through that has been fantastic. And I think that from an employee perspective, in a small company, it's imperative you have that. I know Encore, my brother's housemate, Abby, actually works there. So well done to you for getting a 9-day fortnight, Abby. But it's a small company as well. So they probably have a similar kind of culture where there's kind of that closeness and everyone's kind of very in each other's pockets and know what's going on.
Yeah. Mm.
So to be able to give people that breather is, I think, very, very important. Mm. Like an extra day to be like, I don't have to kind of face the pressures of today. But Adam, you're absolutely right. Like, it doesn't mean they don't go away. Like, you had to come back and still face them. So what else is being done to make sure that the pressure is still there? And from an employee perspective, it's great that, you know, you might be getting the same salary for ultimately less work. But it's similar. Does the work actually reduce? No, the work is still there. Do your hours reduce? You might find you become more efficient. It's a bit like when, you know, I've heard this from many mothers. I'm not a mother myself. Many mothers that say, when they come back to work and they have to go and collect their child at 4:30 or the nursery their child's in will start charging them £5 an hour and then call social services if they're half an hour late. They have to leave at a certain time. They've never been so productive in their lives because they know they have that kind of 8-hour window.
Yeah.
They can't procrastinate because they think, I'll just work a bit later. They know they have to lead that separate life of being a mother or a father, and that makes them more productive. So maybe these kind of initiatives would make you more productive and make you more aware of what you're actually doing in a working day. But I think that, it's a really good initiative, but it's how the employees will react to it, how they will adopt it and how they'll make the most of it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Virgin is an example of a company that gives people unlimited holidays.
Yeah.
And people would think they'd be abused and that the average would be like 50 days holiday a year. Actually, the average goes down because people forget to take holiday. Like, how many times have you come to the end of the year and gone, I've still got 10 days holiday to use. Oh, yeah. Damn, I can't use it. I need to roll it over or lose it. And that happens. And actually, I think the average went down from 25 to something like 12 because people just aren't used to taking holiday and aren't used to taking time for themselves. So actually forcing them to take time for themselves, it's probably a really good thing.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting how it works.
And that's an interesting point, actually, Lindsay, because, you know, full disclosure, I don't actually count anyone's holidays at Exchange Wire either. There's an opportunity.
I think many people have worked that already,
yeah,
Rachel.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all very honest still.
We are. Yeah. I know everyone is. And actually, I feel like we have to sometimes shoo people out of the office to take holidays because we're a small company, so we're all working really hard all of the time, and it's very hard to maintain that intensity. You know, it can exhaust anyone. And so it's really important that, from my perspective of running the company, it's really important that people don't spend long hours in the office, because that's absolutely counterproductive. There's no need for it. And that people don't spend too long working, and that people take breaks and take holidays and are honest with us about what's going on in their lives, so that we can be as helpful as possible. And we also have to, you know, we also have to lead by example as well. So my view on mental health is it's like every other aspect of your health too. You know, if something happens and you've got to go and see the doctor or the physio or the dentist or whatever, it's perfectly acceptable to discuss that openly and to possibly even ask for some time off in order to do that, because you can't get appointments any other time of the day. Mental health is exactly the same, as far as I'm aware.
Yep.
You know, it's that it's, we all need to be looking after ourselves, and we all need to be looking after one another, and we need to open that conversation up much more. And I, the other thing that I feel strongly about, which is linked to how I sort of started this little speech, is I think as employers as well, we need to change the contract that we have with employees, because it's a two-way street, right? So it's I pay you to do a job that we agree that you're happy to do, but I also trust you to do that in the best way possible for you. And I know that if you do that in the best way possible for you, and that it suits you, then it will, we'll get the best outcome as a business. And so it's got to be much more like that, much more even keeled, I think, than hierarchical. Mm-hmm. And I would say that probably a lot of businesses in our industry would think the same way, because it's quite a forward thinking, you know, a tech oriented or sort of new tech oriented industry. I'd like to think that that's how employers think, because I think gone are the days of hierarchical structure of I contract to you to provide me with this. It's got very strict rules around it that are inflexible, and I'm the boss, you know. Leadership is completely different to bossing people about. And I think leadership is important, but an even keel employer-employee relationship and contract is even more important. It's better for everybody involved.
Yep, absolutely agree.
Yeah. Excellent. Good.
Well, that was interesting
chat.
Yeah,
it was. Yes. All agreed. Excellent.
Tick. Nine day fortnight.
Right. So it's Adam's day off today. Moving on to 59A and what you're up to at 59A. We just in prep, we described you, did we not, as a programmatic workflow tool, solution?
Yeah. It's
tell us a bit more.
It's a tech company. Yep. The technology is called Precision, and it's been designed to help improve efficiency and effectiveness across the entirety of delivering a campaign. So not just the planning elements of it, but the delivery of that and all the sections in relation to that. And from a reporting perspective and transparency, which is really key, you know, as algorithmic trading systems are going to become more mainstream in the agency service stack, which people don't really talk much about. There's a lot of talk of tech stack, but service stack, you know, spreadsheets are the tool of choice. We don't think that's the strongest tool in modern day. So Precision is designed as a tool to replace spreadsheets to bring effectively efficiency and effectiveness to the entire process. And that's kind of what the business, the philosophy of the business has been built around.
Yep. And did you, say a bit about how you came to this business as well? Because you were explaining earlier too that, therefore, your clients are typically agencies and brands. So you're working with them directly on, planning, but execution as well. And so how did you sort of set this business up? Did you come from that background?
So my background was I worked in Mindshare for about 10 years, building from basically just myself to a team of 40 or 50 traders. And I kind of see that as not necessarily generation one, but a previous generation of programmatic where, like I say, the tool of choice was literally the amount of time an individual could spend plus a spreadsheet, and all actions largely are manual to then turn that into the system which they're using to buy. And that's all well and good, but we know, and I go back to the spreadsheet limitation, so seeing that as a problem, which has many, it has many, many implications. Pressure on workload, underutilization of technology, underutilization of the planning, underutilization of optimization. You know, just this one small domino problem hits lots of the areas of problem. And watching the team grow for 5 years and leading that growth and development of the team, I realized that was, you know, at the heart of the problem when it comes to actually building effective trading desks. You know, there's new things, new shiny things, device graphs, tracking potentials, and those are important issues. But what I wanted to do is bring it right back down to basics and say, okay, well, if we don't fix the fundamental operational challenges of delivering campaigns, every step of delivering campaigns, then we're not really going to get to the next level of what these wonderful programmatic systems are capable of doing. So that's kind of the long version of the journey. And I had an opportunity to leave and build 59A as a business with that philosophy of let's attack the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of limited tool sets, which are the, I guess, de facto tool of choice, because for some one reason or another just hasn't been that investment from a tech perspective to address that problem. And the numbers are pretty startling. You know, I've got a bit of a spreadsheet here, and hopefully I'm not going to bamboozle too much, but you know, when you build a campaign, you know, when you read the data from a campaign, when you analyze the data, when you then action those insights and the frequency which you can do that, you know, you're talking in the realm of tens, hundreds, thousands of times of being able to do those actions. And that's largely not down to the inefficiency of the person and their inability, but because the tools which they have available to them. When you replace that tool and give them a modern day tool, those numbers change dramatically. And I mean dramatically. It literally rewrites the rules of operation. We're in a new realm of operation. And to give you some context to that, the order of magnitude of increasing building campaigns, you know, more granular, reading data, you know, you're moving from thousands of rows of data to millions of rows of data, analyzing not tens of opportunities, thousands upon thousands, because the machine's you're telling the machine what to do, not the spreadsheet, the actioning and the frequency. And it's of order of a magnitude of 75 of our own internal studies. So just by replacing an inefficient tool, the spreadsheet, with a tool designed for our industry, not a generic tool for every industry, we are able to improve by an order of magnitude. This is not by a factor of 1, 2, 3, but by an order of magnitude of around 75 times, which just rewrites the whole model of how traders, planner buyers, programmatic operate. And that to me, that's a sort of burning philosophy around this is a game changer. And 59A has built the technology. And there's a few of our competitors out there. And it's a relatively new section, but you know, we have a small bet that if anybody, and feel free to contact me, can highlight one of my competitors, our competitors, I should say, because we're transparent on everything we do. We're transparent on data, we're transparent on platform, and we're transparent on business model. And we don't see a competitor in the market who offers that same level of transparency
across the board,
as well as that order of magnitude improvement.
Interesting. And you aren't trying to internalise data or anything, are you? Trying to process it and kind of make it easier for the trader.
Right.
A trader has had many different tools, you know, from campaign, from end to end.
Yeah.
This is end to end management.
That's
right.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. And I remember it literally. And I'm a massive non-trained media geek, believe me. So, and I remember the first experience of literally looking at a log file from a DSP. And let's just draw some comparison here. So a trader, if they're using a spreadsheet, not for their own fault, because that's the tool which they're given in their role, you can't even open a log file inside a person's laptop. It is that large. You cannot open it. You cannot process it. You cannot find the insights. You cannot action those insights because of the volume, and you cannot do that at scale. So you're stuck on square one. Not because the person hasn't got the capability to build processes around that, but the tool just doesn't let them do it. And by investing in the tool, which is what we've done, you just unlock that and you change the game entirely. And that's the motivation.
And what's been the outcome then for some of your clients? So, you know, are you working with a range of clients in terms of their sort of levels of education and understanding about what it is that they're dealing with here? So has it been a process in working with some of your clients that actually that's helped to educate them a little bit about the tools that are available and about the potential efficiencies? Or has it been that you've had other clients who are really clued up on it and kind of know perhaps that this is what they need and come to you and say, look, this is exactly what we need. Can you provide us with this? What's that journey been like?
It's really good. And it's been absolutely fascinating. So it's a bit of both. Some people know the problem, but they don't know the solution. And some people know the problem and the solution. And you've got a whole spectrum of between those two different areas. And, you know, entry level, it's, you know, let's just deliver a campaign and see the performance uplift. And you see huge levels of performance, you know, anywhere from 30 up to 60, 70, 80%. And don't just take the words 59A, you know, our non-transparent competitors release these studies all the time. So it's dramatic improvements in performance. But you're right that because, you know, we can save 40%, at least 40% of a trader's time, you know, they can learn to use that for higher value services. Clients are crying out for more strategy, more creative thinking, more data science, but it's hard to find that budget, right? If you find that in low-level activation tasks, you can reallocate that across the board. So clients are realizing the process benefits to offer higher value services. When it comes to data science, when you get these log files through and you start to apply new techniques, I guess, to generate insights, again, that just fuels the planning cycle onto whole new levels. And the client has confidence knowing that it's not just data which gives an insight, but it's truly actionable data. You know, one of our clients, within I think it was a space of 6 or 7 minutes, we processed a couple of million rows of data, looked at all possible campaign designs, was about 220, ranked them by order, highlighted the winning campaign design, delved into more detail, looked at every single attribute within the log data, ordered it by performance, and then built a 2,000 line item plan within 8 minutes. And that's just one example of the benefit of this new way of working. So there's a process learning curve, to give you the short answer. There's a process learning curve, absolutely, across many different areas of the entire planning and buying cycle, as well as the value. Some clients, some agencies are using it to differentiate services because that's a big problem people don't talk much about. If everybody's turning to the same system and using the same tools, what real differentiation is there in the marketplace? And so we help clients look at differentiation as well. So there's kind of a lot of hit points.
So you're being brought into RFPs, you're being brought into pitches.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so that was another thing I was going to ask is, what about the brand clients that you're working with directly? Are these large brands who have brought certain functions and capabilities in-house or,
So the client's business, and our go-to-market strategy is really anybody who does programmatic, who sees the issues, but I guess more so sees the opportunity as well in this new generation way of doing things. New generation as in stop using spreadsheets and use bespoke technology. And we are seeing a big shift for in-housing. But the challenge on that point is the design of those teams is largely 100% people related. To then, you know, the service stack, whereas the tech stack is what they license. But what we're talking to clients about is, you know, when you look at your service stack, include bespoke technology to help empower and enable your people to do dramatically more effectively.
And on that sort of in-housing piece, are you also working or brought into conversations and discussions with consultancies, independent consultants that might be working together with brands to work out how they should organise themselves?
Absolutely. So, and I think what's really, so from that angle, what's really compelling is when we show them the data and its application at scale and at frequency, it sort of opens their eyes up to the new realm. You know, we have some pitch theatre where we roll out bits of paper which run about 10 metres long, just showing how much granular analysis happens, which is then automatically turned into action. And that's the sort of bridge which wasn't sort of crossed, really. There's a lot of data management thinking, but then it falls over straight away when you hand that complex data set to a human to go in action. You just can't go in action, you know, an 8,000 line item plan and manage it at scale. It's physically not possible. The tool which they've got to look at it can't even open the data. And these are real massive problems, which I don't really see much of the industry talking about. You know, I want to bring this right back to basics. What are the fundamental issues which we need to overcome to truly bring the benefit of programmatic? The myth of, oh, the DSP is fine. That's just not the case at all. And, you know, I give total credit to the guys at AppNexus who saw this. You know, this is 3 or 4 years ago when they released it. And now you've got new wonderful players like Beeswax coming to market who are offering a similar capability. But there's this onus of the client having their own technology to interface. That's where we fit. We're the interface for a client into this powerful technology systems, because these systems are only increasing in complexity and data. And if we don't invest in our technology to work with them, then we're just missing the real opportunity. And that's what 59A is all about.
So this is built off Bonsai then?
At the moment, yeah. But there's a couple of other platforms which we're finishing up integration with. So programmatic is where we're at, but there's a few other channels which we're rapidly working and moving into.
And your team at Mindshare, for example, you had a team of 40 traders.
Yeah, roughly,
and
yeah.
Bringing this tool in would massively be a massive time save for them. A lot of people fear automation because they fear that it will take their jobs away. What, you know, from the perspective of those 40 traders,
yeah.
How would it change how your team would have yeah. looked if you had this tool?
No, that's a really good point. So I meant to mention that. So we're trying to find the right words for it. It's assisted automation. So it is not automating everything.
Replacing.
And it is not replacing. Mm. It is not doing that. So the fear point has been something on my journey that people usually, I guess, pick up on. And my response to that usually is, you know, look, I live in Finsbury Park. And for those people in America, that's North London.
And for those people that live in South London, that's North London.
And I get up in the morning, and I don't walk to work in the travel, you know, in the transport sector. I should, because I need to get fit and all that, but I don't walk to work. I use a train to get from A to B, and that's a piece of technology which is assisting me in you know, A to B. Telecommunications. I don't shout to talk to my mum in Liverpool, which is even more north than London. I pick up a phone, and that phone assists me in what I want to do. When I look in media, the platform which we've built is assisting the person in doing what they want to do, like calling my mum in Liverpool, like getting the tube over here. So it's really, I can't emphasize enough that it's assisting what the people are already doing. And then in terms of, to be more specific on the answer, you know, what would it do to a team of 40 people? Those 40 people could spend more time doing higher value services, which clients want to do. Mm. And that's kind of it, you know. And who doesn't want to do more creative-based thinking, planning, working with data science, because there's wonderful opportunity in the data science divisions within businesses.
Yeah, because I'm just wondering about this. When I was asking you earlier on, you know, I was asking you whether you're working with large brands. I wonder if you're working with small brands as well, because that's sort of much more sort of high level, or well, not high level, but that sort of high detail, granular data processing and targeting could surely help small brands just as much as large brands, DTC brands even. Yeah. And we talk a lot about how DTC brands don't typically necessarily have strong agency interface. Actually, they tend to do a lot of things on their own, but surely what they could do with is, you know, technology tools that help them really process some of the data that they've got and mine it to the extent that it will return some insights that will really
absolutely change the game. I think in terms of, so there's business strategies for small, medium and large, both agency and client direct, but I think in terms of a general rule of thumb, if you use a spreadsheet, whether that be a small, medium, large agency or client, then you're a potential partner of ours. Mm. That's where, you know. And when it comes to another big philosophy of the business of 59A is, it's making the complex simple as well. So when I first saw, you know, Bonsai like techniques writing computer code, we're not the computer engineering IBMs of the world. We are the media industry, and that's very different. So, you know, putting the onus of media people to learn how to write code is ridiculous, because then they would be working in a different industry. So we put a lot of energy into the platform to take that onus off the media operator. So you put in your plan, your requirements, and the precision, the technology that then builds you your algorithm automatically. So it then gives small businesses the opportunity to take advantage of complex operational systems without having to become an engineer in a different industry. And that's a real big philosophy of mine.
Mm. Fascinating. We've rabbited on for like 58 minutes. Really, we better stop.
Yeah,
that was really enjoyable. Thanks very much for coming in.
Pleasure.
This morning,
Thank
Adam.
You for having me.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
All right, that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.